Olaso. So this morning we return to the cultivation of empathetic joy. And as I was reflecting on how this relates to genuine happiness, I recalled a really wonderful time I had a number of years ago with Paul Ekman, a psychologist, Richard Davidson, very eminent neuroscientist, and then the eminent Matthieu Ricard, wonderful monk, scholar, contemplative. And the four of us got together for a day, and we just brainstormed together, and we wrote collectively a paper on genuine happiness. It was really delightful. It was published in a scientific journal. But one of the important points to come out of that, for which we all found, I think, complete consensus, is that the experience of genuine happiness is not simply a happy feeling, however it's derived. It's not simply feeling happy. Even if it's coming from within, it doesn't always feel happy. So it's not simply a feeling. It's something deeper than a feeling, right? And I think that was really quite important. I mean, we didn't discover that, but it just was something that became very clear in our conversation. If we look at the flip side of the Buddhist notion of dukkha, which is generally translated as suffering, well, dukkha sometimes really feels like suffering. It's called blatant suffering. It feels bad in the body, the mind, okay, so blatant suffering. But when you're experiencing the suffering of change, with the dukkha of change, that often doesn't feel bad at all. And that is, you may be having a sense of really doing very well, but your sense of pleasure and so forth is entirely rooted in and based upon attachment. So it's like living in a really comfortable house with a great sound system and an enormous flat screen, high definition television and refrigerator full of goodies and so forth, and your whole house is built on wooden pilings which are completely saturated by termites, and the only reason those pilings are even staying up at all is because the termites are holding hands. Cute construction job. In other words, it looks really nice, but it's just a short time before they, don't hold hands anymore, and the whole thing is just down in dust. And so you should have been anxious. If you were anxious, you were being realistic. And if you weren't being anxious, then you weren't being realistic. You should have a general anxiety disorder. That would be the reality response to living in such a house based upon such pilings. And if one's sense of well-being and happiness and I'm doing well, I'm doing great, life is wonderful, if all of that is based upon the termites of attachment holding hands, then your happiness is not realistic. Put it that way, right? And then when you go to the deepest level of suffering, this existential suffering, then when you're experiencing that, you may not be experiencing simultaneously either attachment or hostility or grief or anger. You may not feel much of anything. But you're vulnerable to every possible suffering, blatant suffering and all manner of suffering of change. So it doesn't feel like much. It doesn't feel bad, but still we call it suffering because of its vulnerability. So we come back to, on a lighter note, back to genuine happiness. And I was reflecting, when we attend to the virtues of others, let alone their joys, and some empathetic joy arises, is that empathetic joy, is that stimulus-driven? Is that simply a very virtuous hedonic pleasure? Okay, something the third dimensional. Is that a hedonic pleasure? Because after all, we're attending to something, somebody else's joy, their virtue, and so forth. And then the whole idea is that an empathetic sense of satisfaction, joy, appreciation arises. Is it hedonic? Which doesn't mean it's bad, but is it hedonic? And as I reflected upon this, my conclusion was, no, it's not hedonic. Once again, let's take the flip side. If one attends to someone else in suffering, maybe one sees one individual, like a dictator, inflicting great suffering on the people under his rule, and seeing how much suffering is inflicted because of this type of tyranny, then witnessing this, one may, as one attends to the suffering of those people, your response may be simply sadness. Very understandable. It may be, as you're taking in the whole situation, the dictator and all of those suffering under his reign, it may be anger, righteous anger. I have a right to be angry. This is outrageous. And start shaking one's fist. So anger might be a response. Or attending to exactly the same situation, the victims and the victimizer, all as an integrated package. After all, there are no victims without a victimizer, if it's a human relationship. Then one may attend to that same reality that could evoke sadness, grief, despair, could evoke anger, malice, rage, aggression, and could evoke compassion. And that's the third option. Same situation. So that compassion, when that compassion arises, there is a sense of genuine happiness arising simultaneously with the compassion. But when you're experiencing that compassion, do you feel cheerful, happy-go-lucky, light? Oh, I don't think so. But that's genuine happiness. It's genuine happiness. Even as you're experiencing empathetically the sorrow of those who are the victims, perhaps even empathizing with the poor person whose mind is so dominated by mental afflictions that he's exploiting and harming the people that look to him for political leadership, one may feel also, I too have mental afflictions, with a sense of sadness. But that too is sukha. That too is genuine happiness. It's meaningful. It's virtuous. Right. So now finally, I want to stop talking in this way. I have to talk a little bit during the meditation. As we're attending to others' joys, and now in this session, attending to others' virtues. There are virtues in bringing hedonic well-being to the world, which we all cherish, rightly so, and those who are doing their utmost to bring genuine happiness to the world. As we attend to this reality, people behaving in such a way, now we're upbeat, something good, something positive. Does this necessarily mean that our response will be positive? No, I don't think so. You see somebody else being really happy, or somebody being really, really virtuous? It's possible, isn't it? Envy. And you'd be happy like that. They don't deserve that happiness. I want that. I'm not so happy. You, and that big virtue business. I wish I could be virtuous like that, but I'm not. And you're getting all the attention, getting all the praise. Yeah. I'm not so happy. Or you could just be indifferent. That's your happiness, not mine. Whatever. Put up the mudra, teenage. Whatever. Not my happiness. You're not connected to me. Not my business. You're not part of my family. Or basically, you're not me. So whatever. I don't care. Right? So it could be envy. It could be indifference. Of course, it could be that which we're cultivating here, empathetic joy. Which means if we're experiencing joy in this, it's not something we're just getting from the object, because that could arouse envy, which doesn't feel good. It could arouse indifference, which feels indifferent, or it could arouse, that is, we can transform the whole experience into joy. But it's not because of what we're getting from the object. It's what we're bringing to the situation. So my vote is the joy we experience in this way is genuine happiness, and it actually feels good. So let's do it. Let's feel good this morning. I think we can all use it and find a comfortable position. Take delight in this opportunity, in which there are so few demands on our times, on our time, almost none. To have this leisure and this opportunity to heal your own body and mind, to find balance, to find a sense of ease. As you settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural state, as we've done so many times before. And now direct your attention outwards to an individual, to an organization of individuals, or some other collective who are benevolently, altruistically devoting themselves to the alleviation of suffering in the world, to preserving the environment, to help others find the success, the joy in life to which they aspire, take delight in others' virtues, contributing to the health, the hedonic well-being of sentient beings throughout the world, human and non-human alike. With each out-breath, breathe out this light of appreciation, of delight. Beyond the domain of hedonic well-being, there is a domain of genuine happiness, of meaning, of fulfillment, of satisfaction, that stems from leading an ethical way of life, nonviolent, benevolent. So once again, let your attention rove and focus on those who are leading such a way of life and those who are encouraging others. You may attend to individuals or communities in the past as well as the future and take delight in such virtue. With every out-breath, breathing out your delight, and on behalf of us all, breathing out the light of gratitude. And then there's another whole dimension of genuine happiness that derives from tapping into our inner resources of the heart and mind through practices that we may call meditation, to achieve exceptional mental balance, to cultivate the four immeasurables by whatever name. Let your attention rove as you take delight in all those religious and non-religious people who are experiencing such genuine happiness, who are encouraging others to explore their own inner resources for themselves and practice as before. And then turn your attention to those experiencing, those guiding others to the experience of the deepest dimension of genuine happiness that stems from knowing reality as it is, from wisdom, and practice as before. release all appearances, all objects of the mind, and let your awareness rest in its own nature. Just be present, without distraction or grasping. Lasso. I had a conversation yesterday with someone who made a very important point. We're, I think, all familiar with it, but it's good to highlight, as it was highlighted in a conversation I had yesterday, and that is in terms of insight, wisdom, knowing reality as it is, the access to this deepest dimension of genuine happiness that is a truth-given joy, to borrow a phrase from Christianity. The sharp edge of that is only one kind of mindfulness, imbued with wisdom and discernment, and that is mindfulness with a very sharp edge, immediately in the present moment. So all the other types of mindfulness, of recalling teachings, recalling this, and so forth and so on, prospective mindfulness, they have their role. They're very important. Because if it were only being present, then you don't need any teachings. Just be present in the moment, and that would be the whole teaching. But to bring wisdom to it, insight to it, discernment to it, the theory is there, but the theory is always an instrument. The teachings are always an instrument, so that we can penetrate more and more deeply. In other words, move beyond the moment-by-moment awareness, just kind of hanging out, to the contemplative moment-by-moment awareness that really penetrates in the nature of reality and sees it as it is. So it's very crucial, really, really crucial. And if we wanted to go just for a moment really transcendent, when you're in the context of Dzogchen, you bring your awareness very much into the present, totally into the present, in that open presence rooted in Rigpa, pristine awareness. And as you deepen in that, you, in a way, in a manner of speaking, you break through the conventional or the relative present that's kind of sandwiched between the future that hasn't happened and the past that it already has. But it seems almost could be like kind of something quite narrow. And you break through that narrow passage into what is called the fourth time, shattering the very infrastructure of time itself. But you don't get there by going into the past or going into the future. You get there by penetrating into the present and breaking through the grid, the manifold, the conceptual construct that demarcates past, present, from future. So those are deep waters. The opposite of this is ignorance, unknowing, unawareness. And what emerges from that is, or what stems immediately from that, is this existential suffering. The fundamental existential vulnerability to suffering. I want to end, but on this note, and that is, what we're talking about here is experience in the daytime, but want to find a strong analogy. I'm going to go back to my favorite analogy. Non-lucid and lucid dreams. So in a non-lucid dream, you fundamentally are deluded. You may know this, that, and the other thing. You may be a really good scientist within the dream. You may be a very benevolent caretaker, a teacher, a nurse, a doctor within the dream. You could be all kinds of things within the dream. But whatever you know within the dream, fundamentally, you're deluded. Because you don't know it's a dream. And because you are grasping onto this dream persona that I'm really over here, where Cecil's way over there. And then people in China, they're way over there. And Brazil and Africa and so forth, well, they're really far distant. But I'm really here. And this is where I and mine are. And then I have my students, maybe. I have my family and so forth. Okay, I have to go a little bit beyond my skin. So there you are, grasping onto I am, fundamentally deluded about everything you're experiencing, which makes you fundamentally vulnerable to every manner of suffering in a dream. So even right now, if you're famous and rich and wealthy and all of that, you're winning the samsara lottery within your non-lucid dream, it feels really good. It can collapse at any moment. Number one, you can wake up, which means you die from the dream. Or number two, things can go sour really quickly.
Right.
In a dream, as much as in the waking state, everything can go blotto. So you can be on the top of the mountain and you can be on the bottom of the mountain within finger snaps. So you're vulnerable to all manner of suffering in a non-lucid dream. And it's not anybody else's fault. Not God, not devils, not angels, not politicians. It's not anybody else's fault. Whoever you meet in the dream, dictators, tyrants, it's not their fault. Not their fault that you're suffering. Not their fault that you're vulnerable to suffering. It's not your fault, like, you just have to pound your health over, it's not to be, have a guilt trip. It's just that you cannot attribute, if you're looking for sheer causality, it doesn't trace back to anybody else. God, anybody else in the dream, demons, angels, none of that. It traces back to not even you. It traces back to delusion. And that's not a person. So eradicate delusion. And then you can see, insofar as you become lucid in the dream, now whether there are dictators in the dream, whether the dream is filled with yogis and saints and bodhisattvas, insofar as you're lucid, then throughout the dream, even if you're caring for the ill and so forth and so on in the dream, attending to other people's suffering, to their joys, their struggles and so forth, insofar as you're lucid, there is. Those of you who had lucid dreams, I think you know. There's a sense of well-being that saturates the dream. And it's the well-being of being lucid, the well-being of knowing what's going on. And therefore, you're not a victim. You're never a victim, not when you're lucid. There's your analogy. Oh, yeah. Enjoy your day and be as lucid as possible.